You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 88 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks. We got a special guest joining us later in this podcast. Danny Kelly will come back on the pod to break down the NFL over-unders that we did before the season.
He is back! We're going to be throwing burgers, drinking Rainiers.
We are drinking Rainiers, but no burgers will be involved in this. This is not a live podcast.
Come on! We're going to be reliving memories. There'll be nostalgia. We'll talk about bad takes, good takes, everything with Danny Kelly.
All takes matter. But before we get there, we want to talk a little bit about Portland.
Portland?
Portland, or as I call it, White Atlanta. We were in Portland last week, and
I'm the only one who thinks that's funny.
Hopefully there's at least one other person who will get that joke. Actually, I did not pick up this beer in Portland. I picked this up here in Seattle. But we have, from Portland brewer Gilgamesh Brewing, the Terry Porter.
Oh.
A very appropriate beer, because we're going to talk about you going to the Blazers game. So $1 from every bottle of the Terry Porter is donated to the OHSU Dornbecker Children's Hospital, of which Terry Porter is a supporter. So that's very cool. And it's got the best name of any beer, I think, that we've had.
Is it Terry Porter supporter?
It is. Yes. Yes.
Ever since craft brewing was legalized in the state of Oregon, this beer was meant to be.
Yes. Oh, very much so. I mean, it's so fitting.
Terry Porter, obviously a legend in Portland.
Not only one of the greatest Blazers of all time, part of, you know, some of their best teams in the 90s, but also now head coach at the University of Portland.
Really?
Yeah, where two of his children play on the team.
But
it's really a Porter family affair.
Nepotism much? We're going to be talking to soon. We had the conversation when we were in Portland, a Seattle legend.
That's right. Hersey Hawkins. If you saw that picture on Twitter of us with the Hawk, we had the chance before the Blazers-Sixers game last
to
Thursday.
To feed the Hawk.
We did.
With questions.
Oh, well done. Well done there. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. He's the second Sonics legend we've interviewed after Rashard Lewis over the summer, and, you know, hope to keep adding to these interviews and get to a number of players from the Sonics team, which, you know, should be a lot of fun.
You give me a pocket knife to open up this beer like I'm a Boy Scout. Like, what am I going to do with this thing?
I don't know. I just grabbed whatever was in the... I assumed that was the...
I think this bottle opener. Twirly thing will open it somehow.
There's a wine cork in there, right? So we spent 3 days in Portland last week.
Filing my nails, at least.
We spent 3 days in Portland last week, Wednesday through Friday. Hit really all of the hot Portland food spots, I would say. Pock Pock, obviously.
I'm nervous. Like, I don't want to get into this too much. You interviewed JJ Redick.
That is correct.
Or as I call him, Jage.
That is also correct. It makes no sense, but it is correct.
Sometimes I call him third Pelton brother Jage, despite the fact that he's never been a third Pelton brother. Still, it feels like he's not a third Pelton brother, right?
It makes sense. He's got the beard is right.
Oh, does he have a solid beard?
It's a little thinner.
My seats were so far away at the game, I had no idea.
That's fair.
But I worry that maybe people like Jage are a little bit more up to date on the restaurants that they're going to. I'm nervous that we're getting into kind of a stasis with Portland restaurants. We're not hitting the new spots because we kind of went to all of the same places. Pock Pock, Screen Door, Lardo. Come on.
Pine State Biscuits, you didn't get to. I didn't get to Lardo. Look, these are institutions, and we have only limited meals to eat in Portland, you more so than me. So it's kind of inevitable that you're going to want to make sure that you get to those spots.
I understand that. I also went to Blue Star Donuts, by the way.
That was your first time there, right?
First time. It was a first timer.
The first time is not free, as it turns out.
No, not even close.
It's very expensive.
I was a little bit let down by Blue Star Donuts.
I feel like I should have adequately prepared you for what you expected from Blue Star
Donuts. The donuts were fine. Like, the donuts tasted good, but I just didn't feel like I had like a passion fruit donut, which was really spicy. Did I mention that to you?
You did mention that.
It was the spiciest donut I've ever had, which really doesn't have a lot of competition because donuts shouldn't be spicy. But it was just, they felt like they were like pretty good donuts. But I honestly prefer Voodoo over it.
Same. I mean, I enjoy both of them.
But I wanted to talk about, see, I go to a lot of football games, right? But I feel like the atmosphere at an arena versus a stadium is a little bit different.
very much so in terms of the game presentation. With, you know, I know a lot of people who work in game presentation, so I consider myself kind of a connoisseur of it. And you don't get that much of it at football games, you know.
It's... No, the halftime, like that. I miss the thing. One of the things that I miss the most about the Sonics not being here is, I mean, first off, just having something to do on like a random Tuesday, Wednesday night. That's pretty awesome. But and just having something for, through the spring too. Like the Sonics can get you through January, February, and March. But halftime shows, like knowing all the halftime shows, the Bucket Boys, like you've probably seen the Bucket Boys before, right?
Probably, although I didn't specifically remember having seen them before.
Halftime shows in basketball are so good.
Yeah, it's a thing.
Like we were, it was the most enthralled that we were the entire game. It was that, and then the people around us arguing about who was going to be fired first between Neil Olshey and Terry Stotts.
Well, hopefully neither.
But the main thing that I want to talk about was the revelation that has happened within the last 5 to 10 years, and that is good restaurants being in arenas.
Isn't it crazy?
I mean, aside from cellular telephones, as I call them.
This take is already my favorite take.
Good food being in arenas is the most important thing that we have done in the last 17 years.
Huh.
I mean, I'm there. I'm in Salt and Straw in an arena.
Wireless internet doesn't appear in this.
Who needs
it? I mean, I guess that existed prior to 2000.
Well, cellular telephones really existed come all the way back to Saved by the Bell.
That's true. That's where they were invented. Zach Morris.
They were called, I think, car phones at the time.
Yeah, I think so.
But I'm sorry. The availability of cellular telephones. But having good food in arenas. Do you remember when we were kids? You would get a hot dog.
No, we wouldn't get a hot dog because our mom would never let us eat inside the stadium arena.
You wouldn't want to, also.
No, I didn't feel like I was missing out on anything.
Like, if I was a child right now and we went to a basketball game with our mom and she wouldn't let us get the sizzle pie, I'd be pissed at her. If she wouldn't let us get the Salt and Straw, which she would have deemed way too expensive for ice cream.
She definitely would have deemed that.
But I had a donut that was $4.50 and I was like, this is far too expensive. But I had that Salt and Straw, which is like $7 or whatever, and I didn't think at all about the money. I mean, you paid for it.
That is true. But it was worth every penny.
But I didn't think about the money that you spent. There's good, the best food, some of the best food in Portland is at the fucking arena. It's awesome.
I mean, I don't know if some of the best places in Portland are at the arena. Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty crazy development. And I would say of the things I am excited for in a renovated Key Arena, the food hopefully being upgraded is high on that list.
If the Oakview Group screws up the food at a renovated Key Arena, I'm out forever.
So they, I don't think, put much about the food in their proposal. They have said that they're partnering with Delaware North, which is a large concessionaire to many arenas. AEG did have like a specific discussion of all the local food.
I remember that. I remember that.
That
I was into there. That. Delaware North?
We were all into there.
What is Delaware North? They had the list of things, right? There was like Cafe Vita in there.
They did, which I don't think they asked any of those places. I think they just put them in there. It was kind of funny, but it did make me feel better about the AEG proposal. But yeah, I mean, the food options at the Moda Center are great. I am personally partial to Killer Burger, number one, and then Bunk Sandwiches, number two, are probably my go-to spots as far as arena food at Moda. And I almost never eat the, like, meal they provide to the media. I will just go on the concourse and get something.
Why would you eat the meal that they provide to the media? Especially because I found out it wasn't free. Like, if you're paying for food, go pay for the good food that Portland has.
I mean, they do have a high quality media meal, but certainly much better than anything we ever had at Key Arena. But still, you know, is someone who believes in the considering the alternative value of each meal, I definitely have to go on the concourse.
Man, it's great. And then also the other highlight was having free Papa Shots in the 300 level. Were you aware of this? Did you know how much we Papa Shotted?
I was not aware of this. First off, I haven't been in the 300 level in Moda for a while.
Wait.
Yeah, I haven't been in the 300 level in a while.
There you go. I'll fix that for you. They have free Papa Shots, two different versions. They have the small kids version and the big adult version right next to each other. So Baby Fantasy Genius went to town. I mean, you know how much he loves Papa Shots, right?
Do I?
He loves Papa Shots.
Is he good at Papa Shot?
If he was at the beginning, it was a little bit questionable. But by the end, kids were just coming up and he was destroying them.
Is he as good at Papa Shot as he is at the mascot game?
No. I mean, he's like... He's better at the mascot game than you are, and I can just be honest with you, he's not better at Papa Shot than I am.
Okay, that seems reasonable.
I mean, I destroyed him at Papa Shot. But, like, so the kids' version, I'm playing with him. Nobody wanted to play. But when other kids wanted, we did this for, like, a solid hour.
Really?
Yeah.
How much of the actual game did you see?
No idea what happened in the game. They reached a point where I was like, okay, we need to go to our seats. And by seats, I mean standing room only.
You also did.
And by seats, I mean the spot that we could sit on the crown.
You also did leave this game early before the Blazers' thrilling comeback to beat the Philadelphia 76ers in what looked like a lost cause.
Couldn't tell you anything about the game, but I can tell you that I beat the famous Cousin Katie at Papa Shot, and I beat Luka many times. But Luka destroyed a bunch of random kids who came down who were much older than him.
It's definitely been a frustrating season for the Blazers.
Has it?
Yeah.
I feel like it's been a pretty good season for the Blazers.
Well, they've been very good at winning on the road and very bad, that game aside, at winning at home, where they have several just really kind of inexplicable losses that have been incredibly frustrating. So they currently find themselves 19-17 and basically on pace for, you know, about a 500 season.
Well, and they played a very important game on the road this week, right?
You talking about tonight when they faced the Cleveland Cavaliers?
Of course.
That was coming off of, they had gotten a needed road win over the Chicago Bulls in overtime on Monday night. Tuesday, they travel to Cleveland and face the return of Isaiah Thomas for the first time since, I guess he didn't have surgery, but since his hip injury knocked him out of last year's Eastern Conference Finals.
Toast Isaiah Thomas.
For sure. His first game with the Cavaliers, Isaiah comes back and is incredible in his first game back.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He was a difference maker off the bench. First off, very good at drawing fouls, including one where he drew a three-shot foul on Shabazz Napier, who literally did not touch him. He just, like,
that's how good Isaiah is at drawing fouls.
He just flung his legs out, and the referees were like, that must have been a foul. Isaiah Thomas, on a minutes restriction, played 19 minutes in this game, scored 17 points on 6 of 12 shooting, and was a +7. The Cavaliers were a +17
nice.
With him on the court, which was ultimately the difference in this game is Cleveland beats Portland 127-110, dropping the Blazers. I said 19-17 earlier. That was not included in this game. They're now down to 19-18 on the season.
So what can we expect for Isaiah Thomas going forward?
I mean, we'll see. I don't know if he's necessarily going to play this well going forward. He was coming off the bench in this one because of his minutes limit. Ty Lue said that in his next game, he's going to sit out Wednesday when the Cavaliers travel to Boston.
Like, come on.
He's going to sit it out.
Is that one on national TV?
I think that is on ESPN.
Oh, yeah, because I saw there's like a splash page on ESPN.com, and it says LeBron versus Kyrie.
Sounds about right.
But if Isaiah was playing in that game,
it would add to the stakes immensely.
Man, Adam Silver should intervene, but okay.
Prevent them from resting Isaiah. Their next game is on Saturday when they take on
Orlando.
The Orlando Magic. So Isaiah should make his first start in that game. It was interesting to see. So I think maybe the most important thing that Isaiah will add to the Cavs right now, like their offense is already really good, but if they can more comfortably rest LeBron for extended minutes, knowing that they have Isaiah out there to be the leader of the offense, especially in concert with Dwayne Wade, he very quickly had great chemistry with Wade as a cutter. So that could be an exciting duo.
I saw your tweet about that, and it started where you were like, I'm interested to see how Isaiah Thomas and Dwayne Wade develop chemistry, and I thought you were going to say that they were playing badly together, but you're saying they were playing well together.
No, right away they played well.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm very excited to watch this. I mean, I'm all in on the Cavs this year.
I mean, I think as Isaiah Thomas fans, you know, people have to be, kind of.
Okay, so we were talking about Portland food a second ago. We should talk about some Seattle food that we're going to have.
So, as we mentioned, as we teased on the Seahawks season recap with Ben B, the early end to the Seahawks season means an early start to our dumpling bracket.
Hello!
A long-awaited dumpling bracket.
So a toast to us for getting to eat dumplings.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to Din Tai Fung on Thursday, by the way.
Are you really?
I am. That's going to kind of kick this off.
We should include them in the bracket.
We should. That's a good idea. So, the suggestions we have so far, Din Tai Fung, Dozone, King's Dumpling House, Szechuan Garden, Szechuan Noodle Bowl, Rock and Walk, Bamboo Village, and Mike's Noodle House. We will call this down to a list of eight. If you have any other suggestions, be sure to hit us up on Twitter at PeltonCast or PeltonCast@gmail.com. Next week on this podcast, we will unveil the bracket of eight dumpling locations who will compete for the title of Seattle's Best Dumpling.
Wow, man.
I'm excited.
I'm a little taken aback here. I think there was at least one that I had heard about that I want. Maybe it was Ping's. I don't know.
Yeah, we can double check this. But anyway, if you have a suggestion that's not on that list, make sure that we get it.
How many do you have there?
That's eight. That is nine.
That's eight.
That is eight. You're right. It's eight.
Suggestions so far is not a dumpling.
That's true. Did we want to, by the way, while we're drinking this Terry Porter beer, look back on my year in beer?
Oh!
For the last 2 years, I've been tracking in a spreadsheet every single beer I drink.
It's the coolest way to consume alcohol.
Oh, absolutely.
By writing down every single beer that you have drank in calendar year 2017.
So in 2017, I consumed 300 and a half beers.
Wow.
From 100 different brewers.
What was the half? You're marking down half beers?
Yeah, I mean, because like sometimes we're splitting one on.
And you count that as a half?
Like on Christmas Eve, I went to thirds because we were splitting.
This is way. I shouldn't be surprised, but this is far too technical.
It is. It is, absolutely. But you want to have a nice, accurate count. So the most common beer for me in 2017. Can you guess it?
Right there.
It is Rainier. Of course, 30 of those, up from 19 and a half in 2016.
Oh, you're going to want to get that up in 2018.
I think 30 is a pretty good number.
30 is really... I feel like I've consumed way more than... every year I try to keep track of this, but the volume is a lot.
You didn't even try to keep track this year.
I didn't try this year, but I can guarantee you I'm drinking a lot more than 30 Rainiers per year.
The most common craft beer, Fremont Field to Ferment, including all the different hop varietals, had 7 of those.
The Field to Ferment?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Most common craft brewery was Fremont with 24, trailing Rainier.
Which makes sense.
30. Highest rated beer this year, something that we had last week in Portland on a rare occasion, Pliny the Elder.
Pliny was good.
With an average rating of 9.2.
In your rating of 9.2?
Yes.
You just drank that and said to yourself, this is a 9.2 beer?
Well, no, at some point I had scored it a 9, and at some point I had scored it a 9.5, and that averaged out to 9.2.
Okay.
We had that, by the way, at the Horse Brass in Portland, a location that pretty much always has Pliny.
I'm out on the Horse Brass, though. I mean, they've got the Pliny, but Apex Beer Bar also has Pliny.
But they don't always have it. You need to check the menu in advance to make sure they actually have it at that point.
The Horse Brass feels like old Portland, and I'm all about new Portland.
Yeah, that is accurate about you.
I'm all about white Portland. White Atlanta.
White Atlanta. My highest rated brewery, minimum 5 beers.
Edit that out when I said white Portland.
This came as a surprise to me. 2 beers brewing, an average rating of 8.7.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure what 2 beers I rated that highly. I guess the Fresh Hop IPA. The Fresh Hop IPA had a solid 8.5 rating, but that pretty much carried it was the Fresh Hop IPA.
I'm very in on 2 beers brewing.
Yeah.
And Seattle Cider Company.
Very solid. So there you go. That was my beer in review.
I just wanted to do that so you could say that.
Got the pity laugh there. Should we move ahead to sports?
Okay.
Seattle Arena. Not a lot of updates in the last couple weeks here. Oakview Group did announce they'll have a community discussion about their plans for the arena and how it integrates into Key Arena and Queen Anne proper at the January 9th meeting of the Uptown Alliance. So we'll have a link to more details about that on the site. No real updates to speak of with the Sounders, who are currently in the midst of their winter break right now. Husky, that brings us to Husky Hoops, which got the men's basketball team got a split of the LA schools. Definitely a surprising outcome for them to beat USC 88-81 on Friday night. Led UCLA early, were dominant in the first half, but then could not make a shot in the second half of a 74-53 loss on New Year's Eve.
What did they finish 3-point shooting? Because they never hit one. It always felt like, oh, they're going to finally hit one, and they just never did. Not even a pity three at the end.
I'm not sure what the streak was, but overall in this game, UW finished 2 of 27 from 3-point.
Oh, my God.
Not great. Not great. But I mean, there's so much randomness in three-point shooting that, okay, I didn't expect it to be a 21-point outcome when I tweeted this and it was like a 2-point game with like 8 minutes left.
Yeah, you were like, this is more symbolic of the Husky season. They got the shit kicked out of them after
not
that.
Not more symbolic, but more, to me, so like the USC game, like it was, in much more so than the Kansas game, it was just a classic case of one team hitting a bunch of threes and the other team missing a bunch of threes, and that's why the Huskies pulled the upset. It's like kind of the classic upset performance. They shot 8 of 16 from 3 in that game. USC had the 3 of 20 performance, very similar to what the Huskies did on Sunday night. So that goes a long ways in terms of upsetting a team.
Yes. It is very difficult to win a game when you shoot that badly. And the Huskies hung in there with UCLA despite the bad shooting for a pretty good chunk of time. But eventually it was just too much.
Yeah, I mean, it was the best defensive performance I think we've seen from the Huskies in terms of the half-court defense, but then because of the fact that they were missing so many shots, UCLA was able to get out in transition in the second half, and that sort of changed the game. So,
but still, getting out of this weekend, which we looked at and was probably the toughest road trip that the Huskies will make all Pac-12 season, getting out of there with one victory is huge.
And it sets up the Huskies. I mean, their Ken Palm projection at this point is to go 8-10 in conference play. There's a very realistic chance of them going 500, which would be incredibly impressive coming off of last season. I think one thing, though, that people have misunderstood is maybe how this team is winning. Particularly during that UCLA game, there was a lot of credit being given to the zone, the 2-3 zone that Mike Hopkins has brought with him from Syracuse. And here's the thing is, the Huskies are 151st in the country in adjusted defensive efficiency. They're not great in offensive efficiency either. They rank 100th there, but still a lot better offensively than defensively. And yet there's a sense that they're, you know, giving opponents trouble with the zone. And I think this is a case of the eye test playing tricks on people to some extent.
I mean, it might have been the case in the first half of the UCLA game.
It definitely was there. I mean, UCLA handled the zone incredibly poorly. It looks like they had never played a zone offense before. Which is weird because they play a lot of zone defense themselves. Although the Huskies did not acquit themselves. They did not cover themselves in glory playing against the zone defense in their own right in the second half when UCLA switched to that.
And I think in that first half, what Matisse Thybulle can bring in that zone defense was really noticeable. And by the time you got to the 16-minute mark of the second half, all of a sudden, all bets were off.
Have we talked about Matisse Thybulle this year? Because I have a point to make about Matisse Thybulle.
Okay.
Like, people are, I still think, a little unhappy that he hasn't developed into a go-to scorer this year, mm-hmm. which was some of the hype this offseason. He's still very inconsistent offensively. He is only making 29% of his threes, which is down from last year hitting 40%. So that's...
He was at 40% last year?
He was.
He just didn't shoot that many threes?
Not that many, no. I think he averaged about three a game. I don't care if Matisse Thybulle scores a single point. He is
For the record, do care if he scores a single point.
He is so valuable at the defensive end that he is still a good player if he never scores a single point. Right now, he is blocking almost 6% of opponent two-point attempts, and he is coming up with 5.5 steals per 100 opponent plays or possessions. Here's a list of the people who have done that in the Ken Pomeroy era, which, you know, is basically modern college basketball. There is one player who has ever done that.
Who's that?
I have to go look up Ken Pomeroy's tweet to me.
This should have been somebody really impressive.
Making
it out to be like this was somebody really impressive.
No, it's not. It's not someone really impressive. That's the amazing thing about it is that, like, all the impressive people that you would think have done it, like Kawhi Leonard or Draymond Green, like, no, none of them did this.
Richard Nixon.
Only some random guy.
That's what the
guy.
Story should have ended with.
And that young man. It's only some random guy who did it in, like, 2003 in semi-limited minutes. Zaki Wadud from East Tennessee State in 2002-03 was the other one to do it.
So you're saying that Matisse Thybulle is having a Zaki Wadud-type impact on this Husky season?
What I am saying is he is doing something for which there is no precedent in modern power conference history.
Interesting.
I mean, obviously...
Wait, what team was that?
East Tennessee State.
Okay.
Not a Power 5 team. I mean, obviously it's
going to
be...
We're going to have to look at their mascot. I'm going to go wake him up.
That's a great idea.
Are they the Mox? Is that the Mox?
No, I think they're Blue Raiders.
No, Middle Tennessee State is the Raiders.
Oh, you're right. You got me on that one.
You
win this
round
of mascot game. Anyway, there's no precedent for what Matisse Thybulle has done. He's been the perfect fit in the zone. He is the single biggest reason why the Huskies have been as good defensively as they have. I mean, which the one thing they are doing with the zone that probably looking at just defensive efficiency doesn't give them enough credit for is they are forcing a ton of turnovers. They are 12th in the country in steal rate, 10th in the country in block rate, and that's leading to a lot of run out opportunities that are helping them offensively.
Okay.
So
they're called the Buccaneers, by the way. And when you Google East Tennessee State University, one of the first questions is East Tennessee State University a D1 school?
What's the answer?
Unclear.
Oh, no.
They were in the Atlantic Sun until 2003 when they dropped football. That was, I don't know.
All right, so this weekend, the Huskies travel will be again be on the road to face their in-state rivals, Washington State, on Saturday afternoon. The Cougars started the year 6-0, including a surprising victory in the Wooden Legacy Tournament, where they beat both St. Mary's and San Diego State. But they have won just twice since then, beating number 276 IUPUI and number 330 Bethune-Cookman, who the Huskies had beaten earlier that week. They lost both of their games in L.A. in this conference road trip to start conference play by double figures. Washington State has one of the most extreme perimeter-based offenses you're ever going to see. They are third in the country in the percentage of attempts they take from three-point range, 46th in three-point percentage, and the combination of those, they are number one. They have scored the highest percentage of their points from three-point range of any team in the NCAA division.
Really? Including East Tennessee State?
Including, maybe. and that sort of shows up, like, they have this small lineup that is very perimeter-based. Defensively, they almost never force turnovers, but almost never foul either. So it's an interesting combination, one that overall has not been that great. Offensively, they're led by Tacoma native Malachi Flynn, who was a revelation last year as a freshman, kind of an unheralded guy who I think was at one point going to a non-Power 5 school before he ended up at Wazoo. He's got a 24% usage rate and a 565 true shooting percentage. And then their stretch four, Robert Franks, who is shooting 41% on threes and therefore has a 627 true shooting percentage on 25% usage. A couple of other guys they need to watch defensively. Backup wing Carter Skaggs has made 52% of his threes, while junior guard Viante Daniels is at 43%.
Just wait till they get a hold of Sam Timmons!
So, I mean, the Huskies are clearly the better of these two teams, but home court advantage being what it is, I'd say this is close to a toss-up, maybe a slight lean Huskies.
Is this going to be one of the games where players like Noah Dickerson are able to dominate in the paint?
You would hope so. I mean, you know, Wazoo does start. They'd start one player taller than 6'7", so that's going to be tough for them to both match up with both Dickerson and Sam Timmons.
And then their offense, if they shoot so many threes, I mean, the one weakness of playing the zone is that you give up open threes.
I mean, the Huskies, I would say the Huskies have not necessarily given up that many open threes. They've really focused on trying to take away the three and have done a pretty good job at doing that. You know, you're not going to take away every three, but I mean, their thinking in terms of the zone is, we're going to make you take contested twos because we're not helping down from the having to help down from the perimeter, so we're not leaving a shooter open.
Okay, I think that checks out from what I've seen.
It has worked reasonably well. I mean, they're still a little below average in terms of opponent three-point rate, but opponent three-point percentage has been fairly average this year. So women's basketball this weekend, or last weekend, we talked about the LA schools being the hardest road trip. Unquestionably the hardest road trip for women's basketball teams in the Pac-12 is to Oregon, where both Oregon and Oregon State are ranked. And the Huskies lost both of those games, but I think we're competitive in both of them. Lost 94-83 at Oregon on Sunday after losing 75-63 at Oregon State on Friday. They will be back home this weekend for the Mountain Schools, Utah and Colorado, who both come into this weekend 10-3. Utah, according to herhoopstats.com, a great resource for women's college basketball advanced stats along the line of kenpom.com, has the nation's 16th best offensive rating. They lost by just two at Arizona State, a tough road game, but crushed Arizona last weekend in the opening of conference play. Colorado, which notably took North Carolina overtime on the road before losing, you'll recall that the Huskies lost by a larger margin to North Carolina on a semi-neutral site in South Carolina. Colorado lost by 25 to Arizona State before bouncing back to beat Arizona. I think that's probably Colorado, the Buffaloes' better chance of the Huskies getting a win at home this weekend, their first in conference play under Jody Wynn. All right, I think it's about that time to air some grievances.
The tradition of Festivus begins with the airing of grievances. I got a lot of problems with you people. Now, you're going to hear about it.
Before and after the Huskies' Fiesta Bowl loss to Penn State, there's been an undercurrent of frustration from UW fans about their quarterback, Jake Browning. I've heard multiple people suggest that Browning won't start every game next year, and they mean because he gets demoted, not because of injury. So I have to ask anyone who thinks this, choose to start a true freshman quarterback instead of a senior who's played in two New Year's Six Bowls? Are you out of your fucking mind? Do you know how many true freshmen have ever, and with college football, that means over 125 years, ever started a game for the University of Washington? The answer to that is two. Marcus Tuiasosopo, who threw 64 passes in relief of the injured Brock Hewitt in 1997. And the other, of course, was Jake Browning, who was decent, but not nearly as good as he was last season as a junior, and not remotely as good as he was in 2016 as a sophomore. The real fucking world. Oh, but you don't get it, you say. Jacob Sermon and Colson Yankoff are so talented, they're top 10 recruits. Okay, so you're telling me they're more talented than Mark Brunell, Brock Huard, Damon Huard, and Jake Locker? Because all of those guys redshirted as freshmen. And when Brock Huard and Jake Locker did play as redshirt freshmen, the other just played garbage time, basically, they weren't particularly good passes. It took time and experience for them to become the stars we remember. Yes, I wished Browning had played better this season. I had higher expectations after he finished 10th in the NCAA in QBR as a sophomore, despite playing through a shoulder injury late in the season. He slipped to 26th this year, a level that probably isn't good enough for the Huskies to compete for a national championship. But have we learned nothing from Keith Price? After his own inconsistent junior year, UW fans were ready to start anyone else but Price. All he did as a senior was throw for nearly 3,000 yards and become the program's all-time leader in touchdown passes, a record Browning will almost certainly break if he stays healthy next season. Some context is in order here. Browning played much of the year without two of his top three targets in Andre Bocelli and Chico McClatcher, not to mention promising freshman tight end Hunter Bryant. Browning's pass protection regressed after an outstanding 2016. The results of the Husky passing game reflect more than just the quarterback's performance. And if you can't find that stuff in quarterback play, then you, my friend, don't know crap about quarterback play. Do you have any reaction to that?
I just don't even know. I mean, I guess I agree with you, but how could you not after that?
I hope so. That's the goal of the airing of grievances. So the Huskies, is alluded to there, lost 35-28 to Penn State in the Fiesta Bowl, a game that they trailed by three touchdowns in the first half before rallying late. Miles Gaskin touchdown got them back within one score, but were unable to get a stop to get the ball back until the closing seconds of this game. And there, the Dante Pettis hook and lateral play resulted in him pitching the ball back to Penn State and ending the game with 5 seconds left. I will say one thing. I thought people were reading too much into that Pettis lateral play because, like, what are the odds that you hit a Hail Mary from the 45 anyway? But they're actually not maybe that terrible. I looked this up. You know, in the NFL, you can do this on Pro Football Reference, and Hail Marys between the 40 and the 50 have actually been completed about 9% of the time in modern NFL history. So, you know, especially in the NCAA where there's so much more chaos defensively, maybe there was a chance that the Huskies actually tie in this game on a Hail Mary. Still, this game was lost much earlier than that.
I mean, yes, it was lost much earlier than that. I just have, if I have to go through a couple of grievances from the Fiesta Bowl, they are in this order. Number one, Savon Ahmed.
I mean, it's like the Huskies are like, you know, it would be unfair for us to rely on Savon Ahmed too much. So let's just save him, you know, not use him too much. He's like a cheat code. You could just play him more.
It's like if you were the Texans and you had Deshaun Watson, who is number one in QBR, and you decided in week one to start Tom Savage.
All right. I mean, every time Savon Ahmed touched the ball, good things happened.
I think he did have one carry for 1 yard.
That is true. Every time he touched the ball as a receiver, good things happened.
Also, Miles Gaskin in the Wildcat. How successful were those plays?
I have always believed in the Wildcat. I have never doubted it.
I mean, I haven't seen the success rate, but it feels like it was about 100%. They did it on almost every third and I think fourth and short with Miles Gaskin, and he picked it up every single time. He was very good, but also the hype around Saquon Barkley. Look, I can tell you, after watching this game, the person who is leading that Penn State offense is not Saquon Barkley. It is somehow a person named Trace McSorley.
It was fascinating to contrast kind of, I listened to all the post-game coverage because among other things, I wanted to hear Bob Rondo's final sign off. And, you know, that was is emotional and great to listen to as I expected. We posted that on Twitter. You know, listening to Coach Pete talk about this game sounded so different than the way the media talked about this game.
Yes.
Because he started everything with Trace McSorley, as did Husky players.
I mean,
they had no answer for him on third down. He completed every single pass he threw on third down, although a couple of them they were able to check down short of the line to gain.
He completed every single pass on third down?
I believe it was 13 to 13.
I have a really hard time looking at, he's a junior, right?
Yes.
He probably will be back next year.
I don't think there's any indication he won't be back.
And it's crazy to me, first off, that he's not a draft prospect, that he's not an NFL prospect.
He is really small.
Because height matters. What is he, 5'10 and a half?
You should have just said Russell Wilson.
But I mean, he's not Russell Wilson. I'm not saying he's that. But the thing that Trace McSorley can do, the every single thing that Penn State can throw at you is what opens up those running lanes for Saquon Barkley. It's like, he's a pretty accurate passer. He can run the option. He's really effective in scrambling. When plays break down, there was a play that broke down where it looked like Trace McSorley was going to scramble and pick up a first down. But then he pulls it up and throws for a first down and gets 20 yards. You're just like, there are so many different things that this quarterback can do. Why are we so impressed with this running back who's averaging like just about 5 yards per carry?
I mean, less than that ultimately, right?
Well, if you take out the long run, there's the long run where Ben Burkervin was not even looking at the line of scrimmage, who's probably the one who would have
filled the run gap. Yeah.
Who would have filled the run gap. Maybe somebody else would have cleaned up the play, but it would have been different had he been looking at the line of scrimmage. And he's at 17 carries for math amount of yards.
17 for math.
137 minus 92 for 45 yards?
Yes.
Is that right? There we go. Let's go. But he's at 17 carries for 45 yards, which, if I'm doing my math correctly, is somewhere less than 3 yards per carry.
It is, in fact, less than 3 yards.
When Saquon Barkley was running the ball, it was a win for the Huskies.
Yes.
Right?
Meanwhile, they averaged 8.3 yards per pass attempt.
And you look at Trace McSorley, he's 32 of 41, 342 yards, 2 touchdowns, and a 90 QBR. I mean, he was scary in this game.
And it's even with 2 interceptions. You know, neither of which were really terrible passes. I mean, the first one was really just probably a great play by Miles Bryan in the end zone. The second one gets tipped.
I mean, when they were throwing deep, Penn State looked unstoppable. I mean, I felt like they kind of exposed the Huskies secondary, who have been weakened by injuries.
Yeah, Jordan Miller was missed in this game. And the one thing I think we really saw more than anything else is that the Huskies just don't have a lot of size out there in the secondary.
No, especially not compared to Deshaun Hamilton. Like,
no.
That Penn State is a good team.
Or was it Juwan Johnson, who was the other guy who was a big factor on third down? And then also, I mean, Mike Kosicki had 6 catches. You know, we saw the balance and versatility that we expected.
Penn State is a really good team, but I have to say that the Huskies, they exhibited themselves well. They exhibited themselves well in this game.
I mean, in the first half, I started to wonder, like, you know, are the Huskies just outclassed at this stage? But in the second half, they were very competitive. And when you take into account the injuries they had, Hunter Bryant didn't get back for this game. Dante Pettis was very limited. All of those things. I think this was, you know, a reasonable performance. It's not something to be upset about.
I mean, to have the ball in the Fiesta Bowl against Penn State, who's a very good team, with a chance to win, was a good place to be. And it was kind of amazing to see Penn State's kicking game be a factor at the very end. It wasn't a factor at all until the last minute. And then finally, it's a little bit of a factor, leaving that glimmer of hope for the Huskies. And Coach Pete trying to kind of recreate the magic that he had in the Fiesta Bowl with Boise State against Oklahoma. Couldn't quite do it here, but I just didn't, and including the, you know, the pass by Andre Bocelli, the hook and ladder play that they tried to execute with Dante Pettis.
I mean, it worked perfectly.
But I had this thought. I don't know if you thought about this at all. If the Huskies score a touchdown there, somehow they get a Hail Mary, whatever happens. Are they going for two?
Probably not, but they probably should have.
I feel like they're going for two. I feel like it just would have been in Coach Pete's blood there.
Yeah, because he was really aggressive throughout the game, like, including punting on 4th and 4. Ugh. From the Huskies' own 48. A play that I was really unhappy about during the game. I aired numerous grievances about this, including tweeting that a punt is a turnover. Although,
tweet that a lot. That was during that game.
Well, I just retweeted it the next day during the Seahawks game because there was a lot of similarities between those two games. It did turn out, when you look at the expected value, at least using the Pro Football Reference win probability calculator, the Huskies would have had to convert that about 50% of the time to make it a positive expected value play, which I think they probably could do, but it's not as clear as I would have expected. So the big story after the game, obviously the NFL draft futures of some players. Vita Vea, to no surprise, has announced that he will be entering the NFL draft. His fellow defensive tackle, Greg Gaines, will be staying for his senior year.
Is Greg Gaines like a...
to some extent
highly considered, and I mean, just I love Greg Gaines, but you look at him and you're like, this guy.
Lastly, Miles Gaskin, still undecided at this point whether he will be returning for his senior year, so that's that'll be what we'll be watching in the next couple weeks here. The other bit of Husky news that we saw after the game, reserve defensive tackle Ricky McCoy announced that he will be transferring closer to home to Fresno State to play for former Husky assistant Jeff Tedford. That does leave the Huskies pretty thin at the defensive tackle spot. You know, Greg Gaines they have there, as we mentioned, coming back, and then also incoming recruit Sam Taimani. But it probably means more playing time in terms of a defensive tackle position for Levi Onwuzurike, who played a fair bit as a freshman, and then Jalen Johnson,
who just looks like a defensive tackle.
I think they'll be okay with that. I mean, they essentially, I don't know that I can detect a big difference from defensive tackles and defensive ends in the Husky system, since they play a lot of 2-4-5 anyway. So, you know, we'll see on that one.
I'll be very excited to see what Bush Hamden can do. Hopefully the Falcons will have an early playoff loss and he can get to Seattle as fast as possible. But what Bush Hamden can do with this offense, I mean, you mentioned Jake Browning. You know, if anything changes for Jake, if anything changes with the offense. For Miles Gaskin, I feel like you have to, as a running back, you just have so little wear and tear, especially as a smaller running back, on your body. You honestly have to cheer for him to go to the NFL at this point.
It's definitely a sensible decision. I mean, I guess the one thing would be if he expects this year's running back class to be deeper than next year's and feels like that gives him a chance to get drafted earlier, that could kind of outweigh that concern. But yeah, I mean, you can't fault anyone for leaving early to the NFL, but particularly running backs. So, all right, on that note, having discussed the NFL draft, let's turn our attention to the NFL and bring in our special guest. All right, one of our, we've done a couple of 2017 year in review things, the music pod, the Seattle sports pod, but something else we need to check back in, another annual tradition, is reviewing our NFL over-unders. And to help us do that today, we've brought back the third Pelton brother who joined us to do live on stage at the first ever live Pelton cast from theringer.com, formerly of Field Goals. Danny Kelly, thanks for coming back again.
Oh, man. Thanks for having me, guys. I'm actually getting worried now trying to remember what my hot takes were about all these over and unders. I have absolutely no memory of what I said.
The worst thing that we do is look back on things that we predict.
Oh, man. This is like cold takes exposed or whatever. So
we've been doing way too much of it lately.
I got to tell you, it's going to be bad for one person in this podcast.
Oh,
and it is
no.
Not Danny.
God. I did the best last year. We were there. It was the first ever live Pelton cast. We were high off burgers and tall boy cans of Rainier, and we had opinions.
And the Sheldon Richardson trade, we were high off that too.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I didn't go through and, by the way, dig up all our Seahawks takes. I know I said that whoever won the Seahawks-Packers game in week one was going to have home field advantage in the NFC.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they play the games, right? I mean, obviously the Aaron Rodgers injury was huge and the Seahawks lost all their, you know, legendary Hall of Fame players or whatever. But yeah, that was, oh man, I don't even want to think about some of it. Like, I was really, really high on the Sheldon Richardson trade. I do think it turned out, you know, overall pretty well. Like, he was a good player for them and everything, but I don't think he had sort of the impact that I was expecting. And well, I don't think he had the impact the Seahawks were expecting either. So, yeah, that it's kind of cringeworthy to think about how excited I was about that. I mean, I think he's a good player, and they actually could still keep him, but just wasn't what we expected
no.
at all.
I mean, the good thing is that no record of this exists on the internet.
You guys delete all episodes after a few months, right?
That'd be a good plan. All right, so in case anyone is unfamiliar, the way the over-under lines work is, I don't know what the source was for this. So I guess Bovada we used. They set a line, and if the team wins more games than that, it's the over. If they win fewer games than that, it's the under. In the handful of cases where it's an even number for the line, there is the possibility of the push. Fortunately, there were no pushes among the teams we did this year. So all three of us, again, did this on the eve of the NFL season, and we will now revisit that, starting with the NFC West rival Arizona Cardinals. We all picked the over here.
Oh, man.
We all thought they were going to be the
really?
Number two. I mean, I think we generally thought they were going to be the number two team in the NFC West. Their line was 8.5 wins. They, of course, went under despite coming up with the win on Sunday at CenturyLink Field, a.k.a. Bruce Arians' home stadium.
God. Did you hear what he said after the game?
Yeah, like, welcome to my home. Like, he really needed it.
I mean, what a jackass.
I mean, it was his final game, so.
Yeah, I guess we can give it to him for this time just because it's his last game ever. But, yeah, that was That was Bush.
They were also an exceptionally bad 8-8, getting outscored by 66 points over the course of the season. Injuries a factor here, certainly, with Carson Palmer missing time, and then also Drew Stanton forcing Blaine Gabbert into the lineup. But and it was an elite defense, but the offense was never there.
I'm actually surprised I picked the over on that. I'm trying to think back like what I was thinking. Obviously, yeah. It's like David Johnson got hurt so early that it's like you almost forget he was on the team at this point. So
be prepared to be shocked at why you made some of the predictions you did. I'm like Lightning under, Eagles under. We'll get there.
Oh, God. Why are we doing this, man? We're telling on ourselves right now. Okay, let's do it. Let's go through these.
Next up, the Atlanta Falcons at 9.5 wins. Tristan and I had the under. Danny had the over. And although I feel pretty good about the logic on the under, still their win on Sunday to knock the Seahawks out of the playoffs was their 10th of the season.
Can't believe it. I still think they went under.
Does underwhelming count for this? Or?
I mean, we definitely nailed the national narrative about Sark as offensive coordinator. We were spot on that regression to the mean was not going to work for him.
Yeah, I mean, it was always going to happen. I think he was kind of set up for failure. I probably said that actually in the podcast. And, you know, it's like, and it's a tough position for him because, I mean, that was a historical offense like we talked about. You know, they just fired on all cylinders all year long, and you just could not expect anything similar to that. Obviously, losing their coordinator who'd been there. It was his second year, so they'd, you know, been really ingrained in that offense and everything. It's just, you just can't expect that kind of thing to happen again.
Baltimore Ravens with a line of 8 wins. We all went under here after their injuries during the preseason. In fact, the Ravens won 9 games despite losing at the buzzer on Sunday to be knocked out of the playoffs and did hit the over here.
Flacco, he was actually kind of good for like a few games this year, wasn't he?
He's an elite quarterback. Buffalo.
I guess their defense was just better than I guess it wasn't better than I thought it would be, but it was good enough to like get them by in a pretty crappy AFC field or whatever. And you know, Alex Collins, did any of us have the Alex Collins picking him to be like this breakout star?
Absolutely not.
I would have liked to have specifically predicted that, though. Like, Ravens under, but Alex Collins will be a star. Yeah. We're pretty busy predicting that Kaysen Williams and Jermaine Kearse would be stars.
One for two.
Oh, man.
The Buffalo Bills did not have a line at this point because there was uncertainty about whether they would start Tyrod Taylor or an unknown backup quarterback named Nathan Peterman, who, of course, started one game this season, threw 5 interceptions, and was promptly never seen again as the Bills managed to make the playoffs for the first time in 19 years.
It's so funny because I think I was looking actually at the interception percentage for NFL quarterbacks this year. I don't have it on like in front of me, but he was one of the top like 3 again, Tyrod Taylor. And I want to say I don't know what Tyrod Taylor's final stallion was, but I think he might have had more picks. I think Peterman might have had thrown more picks than Tyrod Taylor did all year.
The Bills are such a feel-good story that I feel like I need to personally congratulate every single person who I know who has any remote connection to the city of Buffalo for the Bills making the playoffs. But the crazy thing is I was congratulating a coworker today on the Bills making the playoffs, and he was like, oh, but they're going to get crushed by the Jags in the first round. And I was like, just imagine this sentence you uttered. We're doing over-unders for the season, and you're that confident that the Buffalo Bills are going to get beat by the Jacksonville Jaguars in the first round of the playoffs?
This year has been so weird. It's been incredibly weird.
Oh, but to correct myself, 18 years for the Bills since they made the playoffs, not
19. Oh, and by the way, we need to do a quick toast to the Mariners here.
Right?
Who now have the longest
non-playoff
streak
of any team in pro sports. Cheers to the Mariners.
There you go. Is it official now, right? Like they are the number one worst drought.
If the Bills participate in the game on
Stadium.
It's not quite official yet. Okay.
If all of their players don't jump off of cars into charcoal grills just to feel feelings, then the Mariners will have the longest streak.
Damn, that's bad, man. When is it going to end? Well, we're not going to talk about that, but
we'll save that for Mariners hot takes coming soon. Carolina Panthers, a line of 8.5. We all went over here, felt good about their chances of bouncing back, and indeed they did, winning 11 games and
nice.
Missing a chance to win the NFC South on the last day of the regular season with their loss in Atlanta is lifelong Panthers fan. As lifelong Panthers fans, we were devastated, of course, by this loss.
Yeah.
But consoled by the fact that they made the playoffs is the fifth seed.
Is it better? Okay, I was thinking about this, and I'm sure a lot of people already had this thought, but is it better that they won and basically made that Blair Walsh miss like not worth anything? And actually, it was probably better that he missed it, quite frankly, just based on draft position and all that. But like, imagine if the Falcons had lost and that was for the playoffs.
It would have ruined New Year's Eve.
People would have rioted.
It's definitely better for Blair Walsh.
It's much better for Blair Walsh.
I almost wish that would have happened because that would have just been so fucking Seahawks.
I mean, I would have died. Like the amount that we would have fallen to the ground in horror.
Somehow it would have been worse than the Super Bowl loss.
It would have been you would have felt the way that Vikings fans felt when Blair Walsh missed the field goal against us.
Yeah, that's pretty bad. All right, Chicago Bears, a line of 5.5. We all went under here, and indeed
they nice.
Went under, finishing precisely 5-11.
Two in a row. Here we go.
Yeah, building momentum. The Cincinnati Bengals, a somewhat mysterious line in looking back of 8.5. I guess they did get to eight wins with their win, or no, they got to 7 with their win at Baltimore to knock the Ravens out of the playoffs. Andy Dalton, now the most popular man in Buffalo, but I had the under here. You guys both had the over.
What were we thinking? They underachieved, though, I feel like, pretty bad. I don't know. I guess they're negative 59-point differential. They're just pretty bad.
I think John Ross is going to transform that offense.
Their offensive line was just real bad, and Tyler Eifert was hurt. If you want to hear a real funny, cold takes exposed, I actually picked Tyler Eifert in one of my preview posts for the season to score the most touchdowns of any pass catcher in the NFL. That didn't really work out for me.
How did you do in your fantasy league, by the way? You were the Ringer draft was happening while we were at this live podcast. How did you fare in that league?
Yes. I think we didn't do well. I was with Claire McNear. And I'm trying to remember. We finished like 7th or 8th. It was pretty embarrassing. So did you guys read the thing about how the Ringer draft just went awry after all that? Man, it was, I just got back on my phone after the podcast, and it was just total chaos. It was pretty hilarious.
It was especially exciting to know that we had played some tiny role in creating that chaos.
You guys, they like tried to start the draft, and then Claire couldn't log in, so it started auto drafting, and then they had to like cancel it, and it was just this giant just cluster. It was hilarious. There's like 16 of us, or no, there's like 24 of us trying to like do this thing online, and it turned into this 3-day ordeal. It was pretty funny. But yeah, we did not do well. A couple of our top picks, I think just didn't pan out. So it was no good.
I've been there, bro. Speaking of top picks that tend not to pan out, the Cleveland Browns with a line of 5 wins this year, as it turns out, they won 0. Did somebody go over?
Jeez.
Someone did go over. And that someone was you,
Tristan. What the hell?
I mean, it really looked like it would be better. Maybe not 6 wins better.
Better than 0?
Well, they're better than the 1-15 they went last year. Oh, they weren't, God, as it turns out, but it looked that way.
Oh. It's hard to go 0-16.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, man.
The Dallas Cowboys with a line of 9.5. Tristan had the over. The other two of us had the under and ended up winning this.
Wow.
As they tailed off dramatically late in the season, finished 9-7 with a somewhat meaningless victory at Philadelphia in week 17.
The Dak Prescott like nosedive in the second half was weird. I was definitely not expecting that.
Ben B was definitely not expecting that.
Yeah, no, he was not. He was so good in the first half of the year. I mean, I know that the Zeke thing was a factor, and I know that the left tackle situation was a huge factor too, but he seemed to lose like all his confidence. It was pretty insane. I mean, I know that Dallas is like a big market and they're quote America's team and all that, so it must have gotten to him, all the negative press, but man, he just really, really fell off. It was crazy, actually.
Yeah. All right, the Denver Broncos. Again, this is one that you look back in hindsight and wonder, how did this happen? Wow. A line of 8.5 wins. They ended up finishing this season at 5-11. We all fortunately took the under here, and I made this my lock.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
Yeah, I feel
nice. Good work.
The locks actually came out pretty well. Everything else a little iffy, but the locks came out well.
Did you have Denver finishing 29th in DVOA?
I did not have that.
Because that, they might be, I mean, like we both picked the under, or we all picked the under, right? And So I think we were all expecting their offense to be a huge anchor dragging them down, you know, like, or whatever. But I definitely did not expect them to be one of the worst teams in the NFL this year.
Yeah, and for their defense to be as mediocre as they were.
I think Denver is the prime example. We talked about this yesterday on the Seahawks season review of how if you get a quarterback who's like a top eight quarterback, say, if you get a quarterback who is in that top tier, you just ride that quarterback over and over and over again. And if don't have one, it can be a real train wreck.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, like, think back on like the Tavares Jackson offense. And it's just like, I mean, obviously the defense wasn't the same back then for the Seahawks and everything like that. But I mean, I'm just of the philosophy that it's insanely difficult to find a starting quarterback. And you just don't. You just don't move on from a guy like that. So I know that's been like a huge point of contention in Seahawks Twitter lately. And it's definitely an interesting like discussion, I think. But I'm firmly in the do not trade Russell Wilson.
I can't even believe that those are words that you have to say.
It's a white cat for the record.
All right. I'm going to quote the interesting discussion.
I mean, it is, and I totally respect Davis. I know Davis is very much on you know, I don't know if he's necessarily like advocating for it, but I think he's advocating for the discussion, certainly. And it is frankly pretty interesting to think about like what the defense could look like with an extra what, like 20 something million poured into it. But yeah, just for me, I'm just very much in the camp that, you know, you just can't replace a franchise quarterback. It's just too risky. It could take you like the next 10 years to try and find somebody. So yeah, that's just kind of where I stand.
Yes. Yep. The defense with an extra 20 something million poured into it could look a lot like the Denver Broncos,
or it could look like the Jaguars, you know. And so I don't know, I do think it's an interesting discussion. I think it's clearly gotten very vitriolic on a lot of sides, but I mean, I don't know, what are we gonna do all offseason? Might as well talk about something, right?
The Detroit Lions, a line of 8 wins. All of us had the under. They actually went over with a 9-7 record that missed the playoffs and saw Jim Caldwell be fired at the end of this season.
It's kind of crazy. They got their coach fired after winning 9 games. I mean, the Seahawks won 9 games and we're kind of freaking out. So I guess that kind of makes sense. But they were a weird team all year. I think obviously their defense played a lot better in the early to mid part of the season than I was expecting, but it kind of just tapered off. They just never looked like a true contender late in the year.
Yeah. Green Bay Packers had a line of 10 wins. We all went over that. Obviously the Aaron Rodgers injury scuttled things.
Yeah.
And they ended up hitting the under.
I mean, yeah, you can't lose Aaron Rodgers.
Nope. The Houston Texans had a line of 8.5 wins. Tristan went over this one. The other two of us went under. It'd be interesting to see what would have played out if Deshaun Watson had stayed healthy, because their record wasn't as good as their play had been. I think they probably would have hit the over, but again, a quarterback injury ruined a team's season.
I mean, yeah, Watson and Watt, right? I mean, it's crazy actually how different the team was with Watson and without him. I mean, it's kind of goes back to what we were just talking about. Like, you know, a quarterback can completely change your fortunes, and Watson played out of his mind. You know, what do you have, like 19 touchdowns in like 7 games or something like that? It was ridiculous. That Seahawks Texans game still to me was probably the best game of the year.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Speaking of a quarterback injury derailing a team season, the Indianapolis Colts did not have a line either because of uncertainty about Andrew Luck's condition. He would not play all season, as it turned out, and they went 4-12.
The Colts are one of the saddest. They're to me like one of the saddest teams in the NFL. I don't know why. I just feel bad for Colts fans. I mean, they got like the crazy owner and their franchise quarterback's future is in doubt. Obviously, I think Chris Ballard he could be a good GM and that he could turn things around. So that's interesting. But man, they were just kind of a sad team this year.
Yeah. On the other side of things, a happier story from the AFC South, the Jacksonville Jaguars, a line of 6.5 wins because of uncertainty about whether Blake Bortles would start at the beginning of the season or would be replaced by Chad Henne. We all went under the 6.5 wins.
I think that was all on principle, right? Like they tricked us so many times the last like 3 or 4 years. You know, they'd won free agency like 3 years in a row. And we're all just like, okay, I'm not betting on the Jaguars anymore. This is stupid. Like they've been hyped every preseason the last few years. I'm not falling for it again. Finally, they start to actually play like they should.
Definitely a Bortles and Hyde performance from Bortles. A lot of with Bortles lately, a lot less Hyde.
Kansas City, a line of 9 wins. We all went over here, felt good about Andy Reid's chances of leading this team to another strong season. And indeed, despite the loss of Eric Berry and his wound, what looked like the best team in the NFL early on finished 10-6.
Man, they looked solid earlier. And then I think they went, there was an 8 weeks. It actually really reminds me of, I can't remember what year it was, the Panthers a couple years ago when they like won a few games early and then lost all their midseason games before getting hot again late in the year. It was like the Chiefs, there was an eight week period when they won one game. And then then now they're like, you know, they're, I don't know if they're definitely not like, I don't know, most people probably don't consider them a Super Bowl contender, but they're definitely, you know, they're in the playoffs and they're playing pretty well right now. And so they've got kind of this formula, like get turnovers and hit the explosive plays that they could, you know, they could surprise some people. So especially, I mean, just considering they lost, I think 6 straight games or 6 out of 7. And yeah, they just look like hell for a while there. They finally figured it out.
All right. The LA Chargers also in the AFC West, a line of 7.5 wins. We all went over figuring that health and better luck in close games would carry them. And indeed, the Chargers went 9-7 with a plus 83 point differential this year. The best, I think, of any non-playoff team.
They still probably underachieved, right?
Yep.
Like they still, I think they still lost a few or like close games early in the year too. So yeah, that's kind of surprising. It was only 7. That their line was 7 games, huh? That's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of action on the over there. By the way, Baltimore did have a slightly better point differential among the non-playoff teams, but Chargers still very solid. All right, that brings us to the other LA team.
It's crazy that considering how bad the AFC was, that the two AFC teams would have had the better point differential than the teams who missed in the NFC.
Well, it's just because the teams that did make the playoffs in the AFC both got outscored on the season. Oh, no. The wild card teams.
Titans, -22. All right.
I mean, the Bulls were worse than that.
This is how crazy it is with the Chiefs and their start. There was a point where we just, everybody agreed in football that the Chiefs were the best team in the league after like 4 or 5 weeks. And now there are stories about how the Titans with a -22 point differential can go into Kansas City and win a playoff game.
Anything can happen. Anything can happen.
Yeah, I mean, if the Seahawks, the 7-9 Seahawks can win a playoff game, anything can happen. But anyway, the other team in LA, the Rams. Coming off, what, a 4-12 season under Jeff Fisher with their new coach, Sean McVay. Optimism running so high that they had a line of 5.5 wins. And I went under their 5.5 win projection.
Did we both go over?
You guys both went over.
Thank God.
Oh, God, that makes me feel better. I'm glad about that.
Not coming all along.
They did go under 5.5, but that was under 5.5 losses as they went 11-5 and won the NFC West.
Man, they were third. No, what is it? Yeah, tied for third in the NFL in point differential, too. That's pretty good.
Number one in DVOA.
They finished number two in DVOA.
Oh, they did slip to number two with the results.
Yeah, because they rested their starters.
New Orleans moved up to number one.
That's right. Miami, 7.5 wins. We all went under this. No faith in smoking Jay Cutler. And our lack of faith was rewarded here as the Dolphins finished 6-10.
Did Cutler have the most Cutler season of all time?
Pretty much. Yeah.
It was like prototypical Cutler. He looked really good against Patriots, though.
The Minnesota Vikings, a line of 8.5 wins. As Tristan alluded to earlier, he went under 8.5 wins on the Vikings. The other two of us went over. And indeed, the Minnesota Vikings won 13 games and secured a bye in number 2.
I didn't actually remember that I had gone under, but I just knew that I did.
You could just tell that you had screwed it
up. Yes.
I feel like I'm doing better than I thought I would have done. I guess that's a good thing.
Yeah, it is. It is. The New England Patriots, a line of 12.5 wins. We all went over this one. There was some doubt early in the season after that home loss to Kansas City and whoever else they lost to at home early in the year. But lo and behold, the Patriots came on strong down the stretch to finish 13-3 and hit the over. Easy money here.
Oh, God. Yeah, their defense looked like the worst defense in league history for the first like 4 weeks, I think, or 5 weeks. And they've kind of started to figure it out. But yeah, pretty cool. It's crazy how consistent this team is. I guess it says a lot that we all went the over when their over under was 12 and a half or whatever. So
right, which is the highest. Yeah.
I mean, I know people hate the Patriots, but it's pretty damn impressive.
But you look at, I think there was, I mean, they still finished number 31 in defensive DVOA. So I guess an argument that having a good offense maybe is more important than having a good defense in some ways. But you look at the, I think it was a tweet that Ben B had where he was showing the amount of times that other teams in the division had won 10 plus games, I think in the last 6 years. Patriots had two times in that time period. Whereas like the Steelers had multiple ones, the Seahawks had multiple ones. Most of the quarterbacks kind of at that higher level did. And, you know, the road for the Patriots is a little bit easier being in a division with the Dolphins, with the Jets, with the Bills. With the negative point differential Bills, despite them going to the playoffs.
There was a point in the season when the AFC East actually looked pretty decent. Like, not, you know, not like the dregs of whatever the AFC or whatever. Like, the Jets started hot. The Bills looked pretty solid defensively early on. And I think Miami started like 4-2 or something. Like, didn't they start really hot? And then, well, not hot, but they actually won some games early on and then really faded later.
Yeah. The New Orleans Saints, a line of precisely 8 wins. I went under this one. I did not have faith in their defensive turnaround, and definitely did not see Alvin Kamara emerging as the best running back in the NFL. And because of those things, even with an aging Drew Brees, the Saints went 11-5 and won the NFC South.
Did we go over it? What did we do?
Yeah, you guys both went over.
Nice.
Oh, man, that's good. I probably was thinking 6.
You've nailed all the like big swing ones, Danny.
I'm curious which ones I really whiffed on. I mean, obviously, I missed on the Cardinals.
Yeah, Jacksonville.
There is one coming here.
Okay, here we go.
The New York Football Giants. Line of 9 wins. Tristan and I went under. Danny went over this one. Did not foresee the Odell Beckham injury. Did not foresee Geno Smith starting a game at quarterback midseason.
He's in the league still? What?
Yeah. Ben McAdoo getting fired midseason. And all of that left the New York Giants with a 3-13 record.
Hell?
They only fell 6 games short of their line.
The Giants are mystifying to me because they didn't really lose anybody on defense, or not like many major players of their defense. And it was like literally one of the best defenses in the NFL last year. Like, I think they finished like top 5 or top 3 even. And they just fell apart. They're terrible this year. It was so weird. Like, I just don't. I mean, that's why betting on the NFL is foolhardy. Well, betting on anything is probably pretty foolhardy. But I mean, it's like I can't explain to you why, like, all of a sudden they're terrible on defense again. They were so good last year.
Yep. All right. The crosstown rival New York Jets had a line of 4.5 wins after trading Sheldon Richardson to the Seahawks. We all thought they would go under 4.5 wins in their quest for the pick. Instead, they reached 4 wins by week 9 and got hit their over by week 13 en route to eventually a 5-11 record.
I thought they were tanking. I mean, everybody did. I mean, it was, they were trading away everybody with a name on that team. And so, yeah, it was definitely surprising. I think it does kind of speak, though, to, you know, having young and hungry players on your team. Obviously, the McCowns and Curses helped in terms of, like, you know, just like the veteran presence and all that. But, you know, Robbie Anderson and, you know, their safety duo, and I think they had a lot more energy. They wanted to kind of prove people wrong. They had that chip on their shoulder, and they were a lot, well, not a lot, but they were better than most people gave them credit for.
Yeah. Yeah, I think substantially. All right, perhaps the worst line with the benefit of hindsight of any of these. The Oakland Raiders, 10 wins.
Really?
Was there over under? All of us took the under, fortunately. Tristan made this his lock.
There we go.
We benefited from an overrated AFC West.
Man, Carr really struggled this year.
But that one worked out better for Ben than the Prescott talk.
Yes. They were just a non-factor by the end of the season.
I mean, he just looked awful.
Were they a factor at the start of the season?
They were a factor in that one Thursday night game against the Chiefs.
That was a good game. The Amari Cooper game, right?
I may have successfully predicted this over-under, but I also drafted Amari Cooper in the second round of our fantasy draft. I lost in the end.
So did I.
Brutal.
All right, the Philadelphia Eagles, a line of precisely 8 wins here.
Please tell me.
You took the under, Tristan.
Oh.
So he went the under. Why? On the Vikings and the Eagles. Yes.
I can't believe I actually did. Yep. The NFC East is a very hard conference to predict every single year.
It is.
Is it also a hard division to predict?
A very hard division to predict every year. It could have been that any one of those four teams was better than the other one.
But the Eagles, in fact, went 13-3 with a plus 162-point differential, tied for the best in the NFL with the Patriots. And despite Carson Wentz's injury, beat their line by 5 wins.
Man.
God damn.
The Pittsburgh Steelers, a line of 10.5 wins. We all went over here, felt very confident in the Steelers in the AFC North, and we were right to do so, as they finished 13-3 and secured the number 2 seed in the AFC.
All right, we're heating up. I liked it. The Steelers, to me, are, I think we all probably were very, very confident in their offense, right? And they finally seem to get,
right,
like, most of their guys together, other than obviously Martavis Bryant missed chunks of the year, but or did he? I guess he was just kind of in the doghouse for a while or whatever. But their defense was certainly a lot better than I thought it was going to be, or they surprised me just in how they played and all that. So yeah, the Steelers are a super balanced team. I think, you know, they're probably the most balanced team in the AFC, which makes them pretty scary coming into the playoffs here.
Yep. All right. The biggest comeback of the year in terms of a line, the San Francisco 49ers sitting at 1-11 with a line, or I'm sorry, 1-10 with a line of 5 wins. And then after moving Jimmy Guapo, this is what apparently the new nickname is, Jimmy Guapo, courtesy Danny's boss, Bill Simmons, won their final 5 games with him under center and finished 6-10 to hit the over.
Oh, man.
And by the way, we all, let's see, on that one, you had the under, Tristan. The others of us had the over.
Are you kidding me? It's like a guaranteed win. To get to the over, it required a midseason trade for Jimmy Garoppolo in the last year of his contract and the Seahawks injuring CJ Beathard so that the 49ers had to play Jimmy Garoppolo. Come on.
Oh, man.
You guys got the over on Case Keenum and Nick Foles.
All right. One team, sadly, where we all took the over, the Seattle Seahawks, with a line of 10.5 wins. And even before Blair Walsh's kick missed on Sunday, the Seahawks were assured the under, and they ultimately finished with 9 wins.
Moment of silence. Man. Yeah, they definitely underachieved this year. Nathan Ernst on Twitter talking about how he's not going to miss this Seahawks team as much as he misses other Seahawks teams. I think that's definitely probably true for me too. It's like, it's just like, they were just so frustrating to watch. I mean, there was moments of brilliance with Russell Wilson and all that, but man, it was a slog of a season for the Seahawks. I think it was just, they just didn't look like the Seahawks we expected.
Right. I mean, we will miss this team less than we miss the concept of the Seahawks.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Already getting nostalgic for like the old Seahawks at this point. It's kind of crazy.
Right.
I think just like throughout the entire season, we're going to talk more about the Seahawks offseason in a little bit here, but trying to find any sort of rhythm on offense. And there are a couple of moments when you could kind of feel it, but over it never happened over any sort of extended period of time.
Or in the first half.
Or in the first half. Because you can feel it when you're watching, especially the Seahawks, when they're rolling, you can just feel like they're going to score on the series.
Right.
There are a couple times we felt it on Sunday in that Cardinals game. I think the touchdown of Doug Baldwin, I think we felt really good in that series, or the second touchdown of Doug Baldwin. But through any sort of like games, a full game even, that just never happened. I mean, they beat the 49ers with, who was starting for them in the first game?
Who was starting for them in the first game?
This was pre-CJ Beathard.
No, it's Brian Hoyer.
Oh, yeah.
They beat that team 12-9.
Yeah.
You're there.
Oh man.
This is a long season.
So speaking of long seasons, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, after their thrilling appearance on Hard Knocks, had a line of 8.5 wins, which both Tristan and I thought, well, you know what? Let's take the over. At least 9 wins for the Buccaneers. Danny wisely took the under here. And Tampa Bay, one of the massive disappointments in the NFL, finishing at 5-11.
What were you guys thinking? I guess people really, I think, bought into some of the changes they've made on offense, obviously bringing DeSean Jackson in and pairing that with Mike Evans. I thought that was going to be like explosive. I just didn't really trust their defense. And so when their offense really, you know, floundered or whatever, it's, you know, they just had no chance at that point.
Next year, just mark me down for an under for whoever's on Hard Knocks.
Joe McCoy has so much personality.
I don't care what the line
love
is.
Love him.
Is it going to be the Rams? I hope it's the Rams. Well, they kind of recently did it.
Just had that.
I think it could be the Niners, though.
Yeah, I saw that suggested.
That's who it is. Yes, I knew it was an NFC West team. Okay, cool. That would be fun.
More NFC West Hard Knocks.
Yeah. All right, the Tennessee Titans, a line of 8.5 wins. We all went over here. And even though the Titans were a disappointment, as we mentioned earlier, were outscored on the season, still they got to 9 wins and hit the over.
I mean, they were terrible for the last month. That's like, how can you believe they beat the Jaguars in that game? Like, who expected that? I don't know. The Titans are a hard team for me to figure out. I wrote about Kevin Byard, the safety, this week, and how he's kind of like the X factor for them because he's kind of just this ball hawk in the middle of the field for them. But I mean, their offense was really bad. Mariota had a terrible year. He had 13 touchdowns and 15 picks this year.
Nobody saw that.
I didn't expect that. Yeah.
All right. Lastly, the Washington professional football team, a line of 7.5 wins. We all went under here and we were all correct. In fact, the Washingtons finished at 7-9. Losing their finale to the New York Giants.
They had quite a few injuries, and I remember my logic being that they're just losing so many of their offensive players, like Deshaun Jackson, Pierre Garçon. I figured that was going to be really tough for them to overcome. And I mean, their offense still was pretty decent. Cousins had a pretty good year, but they needed Cousins to be like on point, like what he was last year, and it just wasn't the same.
Nope. All right, so the final tallies here. Remember, these are out of 30 because there are teams that did not have a line. Tristan went 14 out of 30. Could have been worse. I went 19 out of 30. And Danny went an impressive 21 out of 30.
Wow, that's really good.
Wow. Is that good? Like, I don't know what would like a professional better do, I wonder.
Did you look up the money on this?
I did look up the money.
Okay, here we go.
The return on your investment, had you in fact bet, it's a little bit worse than it looks from the percentages because usually we picked whatever was the more popular right, the where favorite. There had been more action. So the odds were worse. Tristan would have lost 25% of his money. I would have basically...
Can you attach a dollar amount to this? Let's say that we bet $1,000 total.
Wait, okay, you would have lost $246.
Okay.
I would have made $21, a modest return, but enough to keep you in business.
21.
And Danny would have won a solid $88 on his 1,000 investment.
That's all, $88? Damn, we should not bet on football.
This is why I don't bet.
We'll just bet the locks. I mean, we did very well in the locks.
Man. Did I have a lock or did I just kind of pick after you guys made your locks? I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't have you recorded as having a lock. Okay. So I don't know if you did that. Well, so
they were all locks for you.
21 out of 30. I'm going to try and remember that. I'm going to try and remember that and do better next year because, I feel like, well, I guess there wasn't too many that are just like totally head scratching. I mean, there was just a few teams that really just sucked when you expected them to be good and vice versa. So I don't feel too bad.
No, I feel like that's a really good number. Out of 21 out of 30?
It's not shabby. Not shabby.
All right. Well, we wanted to touch specifically on a few of the teams who fared differently than expected, specifically in the Seahawks division, the NFC West. You wrote after the game on Sunday about how this is a division on the rise with the Rams, with their first year head coach, Sean McVay, and second year quarterback, Jared Goff. And now the 49ers, as we mentioned, winning 5 in a row to close out the season with their new quarterback, Jimmy Garoppolo, and their first year head coach, Kyle Shanahan. Also seems like, you know, changing the guard, not just with the Seahawks, but also Arizona, which after finishing 8-8, saw both head coach Bruce Arians and quarterback Carson Palmer within the last couple of days announce their retirement. So what do we make of the NFC West going into 2018 and beyond?
It feels like the Seahawks and the Cardinals are kind of the old men on the block at this point.
Which is fitting with their coaches.
That's true. Yeah. Man, when the report came out that Pete Carroll might retire, I definitely was really skeptical about that to start. Obviously, the Glazer quote report wasn't really a report so much as he was saying, you know, Pete Carroll's an old person and so he therefore might retire. But that was kind of a thing that I noticed as the season went on. Pete Carroll even said it, I think, after they played the Rams. I mean, that Rams game was eye-opening because it felt like the Rams felt like the Seahawks of old. Yep. Like, you know, very, very fast, free-flowing, just, you know, chip on their shoulder. You know, they had the sort of little brother syndrome, tired of getting beat up by big brother, and finally just, you know, figured out how to beat them kind of thing. And they just pounced on the Seahawks. And so I think the Seahawks looked a little bit slow. And, you know, they obviously had a ton of injuries, and that's a huge factor. Obviously, Bobby Wagner was not 100%. They were without KJ Wright. So there's huge caveats to everything. But to me, it's like just I think the Seahawks just need to get a little bit younger and hungrier. And we talked about it a little bit with the Jets, like, you know, just had that chip on their shoulder and wanted to prove people wrong. I know that's very like vague and sort of just sports, you know, sports line type of thing. But I do think it's true. I think it was a big part of the Seahawks sort of identity early on and part of their success early on. So it just doesn't feel like they had it that much this year. And, you know, we could go into what I think is kind of bland and stale offensive philosophy and offensive schemes and things like that. And I do think at this point, it took me a long time to kind of get on board with the idea of moving on from Tom Cable and maybe even Daryl Bevel, but I'm kind of on board with that at this point. I think they need a change. I mean, we've seen some teams when they make a change in the coaching staff have a huge difference maker the next year. And I just think the way that the Seahawks kind of have approached things, it just doesn't seem to be working anymore.
Yeah, it didn't really sound, though, from Pete Carroll's comments, both on the Pete Carroll show Tuesday morning and then his kind of season wrap-up press conference with media later on. It didn't really sound like we should expect a change in those positions.
No. It feels like it would have happened at this point, right? I mean, I don't know what they're waiting for now. It feels like if they were going to do, you know, major changes, they probably would have already done it. So I guess we'll be left with, in my mind, hoping the team gets a little bit younger, faster, you know, reload. I think the idea that they're a rebuilding team is kind of silly, frankly. I think, you know, they still have a franchise quarterback. They still have a ton of talent on defense. They still won 9 games. You know, they're a top 15. I think they finished 14th in DVOA, and that was with all the injuries. So they're still a team that can compete. They do need to get better. I don't think they've been nearly as good as they were in the last few years. But, I mean, there's still a ton of potential there. And, I mean, we've seen, just looking at the over-unders, we've seen a ton of teams that can kind of change their fortunes with a few key players. I mean, look at what happened with the Saints in terms of, you know, they had a couple of rookie players that came in and made all the difference in the world. So I don't think a rebuild is in – you know, in order. I think that's just kind of silly. I think they just need to reload.
Yeah, definitely agree with that.
Well, and as far as getting younger, especially on defense, I mean, Pete today talked about both Cam Chancellor and Cliff Averill. It seems like the chances of them being on the team next year kind of slim at this point. I mean, he said that they're going to have a hard time playing football again. And it seems like the odds at this point would be for them both retiring. The defense is going to look different. And I don't know exactly how they're going to get younger with the lack of draft picks that they have. They're almost certainly going to burst into more draft picks. You know, they've done it consistently, but it feels like they're going to have to just draft defensive player after defensive player after defensive player to try to replace these people who are leaving, or feel really confident and say the players that they drafted last year in Delano Hill or Tedrick Thompson there.
Yeah, I mean, they've got a few guys kind of on the come up. I know that Deion Jordan didn't play a ton of snaps, but he looked really good in limited action. You know, I don't know, he's not like necessarily the youngest guy, but he just hasn't played a ton, and so he could be a guy that features that you don't really expect. And I think that's the kind of thing you have to, like, that's how it works. Like, when I say get younger, it's you get contributions from players that you're not expecting to contribute. And I mean, that's in the form of guys that were like practice squatters last year or backups, draft picks. It's just, it's hard to map it out at this point because we haven't really seen a ton from any of these guys, but I think that's kind of part of it. It's like, did we all expect Shaq Griffin to be as good as he was this year? Probably not. Like, most people, probably not. And a guy like Justin Coleman, who they got in a draft in a trade with the Patriots, like, these are the types of players that kind of like come out of nowhere. I think is kind of what I'm getting at. I don't have it like all mapped out, but I think that's kind of you've seen a little bit of like the glimpses of young guys coming in and doing well, like for some of the veterans, like names that we've known.
Well, and one thing that was a little bit disconcerting with Pete's comments today, saying that Malik McDowell's future still remains uncertain even after missing the entire rookie season.
Yeah, man, that's crazy. I mean, it's still confusing because they still haven't really told us any specifics on it. I think, I guess they're respecting McDowell's wishes on that and letting him, you know, when he's ready or whatever, tell us what happened. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely discouraging. Hopefully, you know, you feel for the guy. Hopefully he hasn't lost any quality of life or anything like that. But obviously, you really, really hope that he can play next year. So it's just weird not knowing kind of anything about what's going on.
Yeah. And I mean, it feels like a case, as it has been all along, of them, you know, they've probably withheld some details that they know of the specifics of his condition, but they probably don't know much more than we do about his chances of actually playing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a head injury where they just don't know at this point.
Yeah. Did you read anything into, it was mentioned, you know, I think Brady Henderson from ESPN pointed this out, that, you know, Carroll was talking about defensive linemen who could be a factor next year, and he didn't mention Michael Bennett in that group. Do you read anything into that?
This is like the LeBron letter. He didn't include Andrew Wiggins in it.
I don't know. I didn't really think much of it. I mean, Carroll kind of just goes off on tangents and he rambles, you know, at times. I think it's not like he's definitely still like all there. Like, I'm not getting at that. I'm just saying, like, he, you know, he'll say like 3,000 words in an interview and parsing it out into like whose name he mentioned and things like that. I don't really think it's probably that meaningful. Yeah, so I don't read that much into it. I think Bennett was still definitely a productive player, and I know that his pressure numbers and his tackle for loss numbers were still pretty good. So, you know, he's still a solid player for them, and I don't think he's overly expensive next season. So it wouldn't surprise me a whole lot if he was back. I think they do need guys like Frank Clark and like I said, Deion Jordan, some of these guys to step up, maybe Marcus Smith or whoever. Quinn Jefferson looked good at times. And there's some guys on that defensive line, you know, Naz Jones and Jaron Reed, who really flashed at times too. So I think they do need some of those guys to really step up and not make, if Bennett is back, not make him play so many snaps. But it wouldn't surprise me if he was back. And then again, it wouldn't surprise me if he wasn't back either, just because, you know, he's getting older and all that. And there were times when he looked pretty slow, but yeah, I think he's probably still in their plans, I would say.
Well, and something we can be certain of is that Pete Carroll's philosophy going into this offseason is not going to change.
No.
He's still very much committed to getting the run game going and having a balanced offense. And two things that I feel more certain of than I did before today, and maybe I'm going to throw a third one in there. Number one, if he's not hired for a head coaching position, Tom Cable, and we'll throw Bevel in there too, are going to be back. Number two, I predicted this in our bold predictions for 2018. The Seahawks are going to draft a running back within the first three rounds. Even though they feel very good about Chris Carson, this team thinks they need a beast of a running back. And number three, Thomas Rawls will not be on the team next year.
Yeah, I got that impression too, definitely on number three. Yeah, it sounds like their running backs coach really laid into Rawls last week after he nearly got flagged or whatever for barking at a guy, and then, you know, Rawls went out and did the same thing and got flagged. And I guess, I don't know, I didn't actually hear the quote, but it sounded like he didn't know why he got flagged or something like that, which it's like, okay, come on, man. Come on, man. So yeah, that wouldn't be surprising. I think I agree with you on the other ones too. Like, I do think they see the value in having like a stud running back, and I know that we say this every year. We literally say this every year, but the running back class does look really, really impressive. So I think in that second, third round range, you could probably find a guy that could come in and start for you and be a difference maker. I know there's two schools of thought on drafting a running back in the first round, but I think in the second or third round, you know, it's worth it. I mean, look at Kareem Hunt, what he did this year. He was a third rounder, and I think that's still a really good value for you. So I wouldn't be against that.
All right. Perhaps the most important note I thought from today's Pete Carroll interview was him noting that he feels better than ever is part of why he doesn't plan to retire after switching to a plant-based diet during the season.
Why didn't he just call it a vegetarian? Plant-based diet? That's the
Pete Carroll way.
I feel like it sounds hipper that way.
Switch to a plant-based diet.
I did just get this note from Darren K at Hey D Train on Twitter, noting, does Pete know that chewing gum isn't always vegan? Oh no.
Oh no.
I mean, I think it's okay given that, you know, it's not really like an ethical decision necessarily for Pete Carroll. It seems to mostly be about health. So I think, you know, the chewing gum will probably not be too much of a problem here.
Look, Pete Carroll's trying to be immortal. That's the other thing I'm certain of, is Pete Carroll's not retiring. He's not thinking about retiring anytime soon.
Would it surprise you even a little if Pete Carroll came out and said something like, we're 5 years away from human beings being immortal?
No, definitely not.
Wait, what's the
he's like, Chris, I looked into it.
Scientists believe that the first human to live to 150 or something like that is already alive. I intend to be that human being.
He's reading all those stories about basketball players and their plant-based diets and got into it.
I hope he didn't do this because of Kyrie Irving.
He's going to be a flat earther soon.
He probably is, let's be honest.
You probably are.
Let's not go there. Let's not go there. So the other thing that happened this week, a brief spasm, let's say, pang of concern from Seahawks fans after Packers GM Ted Thompson announced that he was going to leave that role and move into an advisory role with the organization. John Schneider, the Seahawks GM, grew up in Wisconsin, spent 12 years with the Packers over two different stints, and worked most recently under Thompson as director of football operations before joining the Seahawks. So some legitimate concern there, although then Carroll followed that up today by saying that, yeah, I am convinced that Schneider will return as GM next season.
How much do we believe him?
It was interesting, the parsing the way he answered the question in the press conference, because he also said, I'm convinced I'm answering the question the way it was intended. And I don't know why you'd say that if you...
It's like legalese.
Yeah. What is? That one was a little weird.
Relations. He did talk about his relations with John Schneider.
Oh, no.
You know how it's kind of like a marriage, and he compared it to, you know, marriage, how each you know, partner tries to make each other better and all that. It sounded to me like it was more of a non-answer than anything, because I don't think it's decided at this point. He's probably saying odds are it's not going to happen. You know, I expect him to be here and all that, but we'll find out. It would not surprise me even a little if they pursued Schneider. But I don't know. Schneider's got a good thing going here. I don't know if it makes a big difference that's where he came from and where he came up and all that. But he's definitely got a good situation here in terms of what I think, just based on what we know, like the way that the system works with Pete Carroll. And, obviously, I think he's well paid. So I don't know. We'll see. I personally don't think he'll leave, but it's something to monitor because I do think it's within the realm of possibility.
Yeah. I mean, I would put it this way. I don't think that there's any other GM job that John Schneider would leave for but Green Bay.
Right, right.
So, you know, it's either kind of now or never, probably, in that case.
Oh, now I'm getting more nervous.
Oh, no. Didn't
do that. You just convinced me that maybe I should be more nervous.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah, it would be a big story.
It's like, cause an uproar in Seahawks Twitter?
It's a circus.
Something that did not cause an uproar in Seahawks Twitter was that defensive coordinator Chris Richard is interviewing with the Colts for their head coaching job. Tom Cable not among the announced interviews so far for the Colts. And part of me does wonder if that Michael Silver tweet last week was kind of a trial balloon from the Colts organization rather than, you know, like serious interest from them.
I feel like Tom Cable's an Ursae guy.
I do see how they could connect, but you can't connect if you're not conducting an interview.
Well, Ursae was talking about how he wants them to draft a running back in the first round. They have the third overall pick or whatever. So I
wonder if Trent Richardson's out there.
Maybe. Yeah, I know, right? You'd think he would have freaking learned from that. But it was kind of interesting, actually, that I don't think, like you said, it did not really cause much of a ripple that Richard was getting interviewed. Do people feel that lowly about or feel that low about Richard at this point? I think he's a pretty good coach. I don't have a negative feel for him.
I think Pete gets 100% of the credit for the defense.
Yeah,
especially because we've been through coordinators and the defense has kind of maintained the stasis going from Gus Bradley to Dan Quinn to Chris Richard.
But then it hasn't been as good under Chris Richard.
We credit the defense for getting old, not Chris Richard.
I know. I don't think that it would be a good thing if he left or got the Colts job. But I also don't think that you often get a head coaching job off 2 years of coordinating when the second year your team was 13th in points allowed. That's really not kind of the path.
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's a good point. I mean, it is a little bit surprising that he's already gotten head coaching. You know, the other thing that it could be, and again, this is probably being too cynical, but, you know, sometimes these interviews are sort of favors to certain coaches on like getting your guy interview experience, getting his name out there, things like that. You know what I mean? Yep. Like, I don't know if that's what's happening. This is me totally just like speculating or whatever, but that could be another part of it. It's like you get your guy some interview experience and get him that knowledge on kind of what happens in those things. And that might be kind of what's going on here.
Yeah, too. Because I think in a couple of years, Rashard could be a more attractive candidate, especially if you see someone with kind of a similar background, a young secondary, you know, a young defensive coordinator with secondary experience. If one of those guys has a successful first year, and then all of a sudden everyone is looking for that, as opposed to right now, everyone is looking for a Sean McVay type.
Tom Cable. I feel like it's a Sean McVay type. Kyle Shanahan, Sean McVay, Tom Cable. What do they all have in common? They're all coaches in the NFC West. Think about it.
It's beautifully accurate. Maybe the other bit of Seahawks news that came out of Pete Carroll's media availability today, that Richard Sherman will have a cleanup procedure to remove bone spurs from the other foot, the other ankle slash heel, besides the one that he ruptured the Achilles on. Shouldn't really affect his timetable for return. Probably a good time to get that cleaned up while he's already rehabbing.
Yeah. I mean, it was like a 4 to 6 week rehab. I mean, his Achilles situation is probably going to go into next season, isn't it? I mean, I guess I'd never really researched it closely, but I'm kind of just going into this with the assumption that he probably won't be back before the beginning of the year.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think, you know, right before the start of the season at the very earliest, given the timetable with Achilles.
Right. I guess the free agent situation is it's going to be something to watch. Are you guys on the Jimmy Graham back train? Or are you ready to let him go?
I mean, I wouldn't be unhappy if he was back, depending on the number, but I think realistically he probably is going to be gone.
Yeah, that's kind of where I am. I think I'm kind of just expecting him to be gone. I mean, I can't remember who wrote it. Was it Greg Bell? Maybe talked about how he just never really seemed to want to be here, which does kind of feel right, although he is very good friends with Russell Wilson. But the one thing that does make me nervous is like Ben B, you know, tweeted it the other day. It's like the Seahawks cannot run in the red zone. And so if you're going to get rid of your only red zone weapon, that is worrisome to me. I know that he wasn't very effective anywhere else at this point, but he's basically a trump card inside the 5 yard line. And that is valuable to me.
They're going to have Saquon Barkley to do that next year.
All right. Well, if that's the case, then let's do this.
You're actually going to run for yards inside the 10 next year?
I'm not saying that. My bold prediction is just having him.
A yard.
I will go out on a limb. Yes. Positive rushing yards inside the 10.
Wow.
You heard it here first.
Takes are hot.
This is a good one.
The graph Ben B posted of like the rushing yards.
Think about how hot of a take that would have been before the year if you would have predicted that the Seahawks would
get zero
yard before. Like you would be like, "This is insane." Of course, they're going to run for a yard,
and then you would have the last laugh. Boy,
man, if you could have bet on that,
their run game was incredibly inept, just unbelievably inept. It was. Oh God. Okay, let's not talk about it anymore. It's got to go better next year. I feel like there's only one way to go.
Seahawks can make regression to the mean work for them.
Exactly. That's our motto for next year.
Kicking game two. All right. On that note, thanks so much for joining us, Danny.
Absolutely. That was fun. It was kind of fun to go back and listen to our hot takes early on in the year. It's been a fucking weird season. Am I allowed to swear on this? I feel bad, actually.
Yeah, go for it.
Oh, yeah. Let's definitely do it again next year. That was really fun. I'm trying to beat my record from last year.
Yeah, certainly more fun for you to revisit those than it was for Tristan. And on that note, thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys.